Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a sport-tuned suspension. Learn more at Acura.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Novelist and digital world icon William Gibson made his name writing darkly gleaming science fiction. The future he described was a dystopia saturated with technology, disembodied digital lives, and a menacing undertow of fear. A lot, you might say, like 2007. After 9/11, says Gibson, the future ended up on the windshield of the present. Now, the man who coined the term cyberspace is writing wild fiction set in the here and now, with a cold civil war on in the USA and cyber shadows moving onto the streets. Up next on Point, William Gibson and his latest novel, Spook Country. Joining me now from Seattle is William Gibson, a giant icon for the country's digerati and science fiction readers. His 1984 book, Neuromancer, was the first novel to win all three major science fiction awards, the Nebula, the Hugo, and the Philip K. Dick Award. In 2003, he moved to the here and now with his best-selling novel, Pattern Recognition, with Spook Country. The Washington Post calls him one of the country's most astute and entertaining commentators on our astonishing, chaotic present. William Gibson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Spook Country. What's your shorthand for what this one's about? How do you begin to explain it?
Oh, well, actually, I don't. I have, like, no talking points to I never do to present novels. It's, I think I actually write novels to encourage other people to find their own talking points. I think the closest thing I have to an editorial position in this one, which is something I usually don't try to do, comes out when several of the characters are sitting around discussing the current state of the digital, and the word cyberspace comes up. And a digital art curator at that point announces that cyberspace is, as she says, everting. Mm-hmm. That is, it's turning itself. It's turning itself inside out. And I think that something like that is going on now, and that in a decade, maybe less than a decade from now, cyberspace will be a sort of nostalgic term in somewhat in the way that it's no longer, you know, in the 19th century, if something was electric, they prefaced it with electric.
Like Electrolux, electro this, electro that, electro everything in those days.
Exactly. But no, you know, Apple doesn't need to sell you your electric iPod. You take it, you take it for granted. Now, I think our very use of, like, the digital is going to go away because the times, the moments in our lives that are going to be most exceptional will be ones in which we're not connected.
You know, I love that concept, and it's very catchy and woven all through here. I want to look at your sense of how things are everting from cyberspace, the kind of example that you put at the heart of this book is a one-time indie rocker on the trail of an artist who's practicing what he calls locative, if that's how you pronounce it, locative.
You know, I'm not sure. My Canadian wife corrects me when I say
locative, locative, locational. Anyway, locative art.
Yeah, let's go for locative for now. I think it's kind of a dialectal difference anyway.
Yeah, well, art in one time, in one place, only visible from one angle. Could you describe what your fictional artist does? It seems like the beginning of a very concrete example of eversion of cyberspace.
Okay, although it's actually not visible from only one angle. You'd be able to walk
Oh, well, I guess I'm too specific, but I mean angle more broadly, only when you're tapped into that channel of virtual reality, if you will.
Yes. Well, it's one of those... This in the world of excuse me of in the world of digital art, or this thing that I'm trying to describe is sometimes referred to as blended reality, rather than virtual reality. Mm-hmm. When you access virtual reality, you've got a kind of full 360 surround of Second Life or whatever you're in.
Right. You've got your headgear on and your visuals and your earplugs in and you're there.
Yeah, and in a blended reality, you'd have your headgear on, but there could be a completely digital object on your desktop on the table in front of you, which you could move around and examine from different angles, or it could be animated and moving, or you could be driving in your car and there would be objects which aren't there outside your window. I'm sorry, my voice
not at its best. It'll come to you. What they seem and not what they seem at the same time. And you're a fictional artist here obsessed with recreating celebrity events at the location where they occurred, the death of River Phoenix in, 1993 on Sunset Strip. If you're tuned in to his channel of virtual reality or blended reality with the headset on at that spot, you can see the body of River Phoenix there on the sidewalk as it would have been 25 years ago.
Well, as he's imagined it.
As he's imagined it.
Yeah, as he's imagined it.
And there's his artwork, but it's that eversion of cyberspace kind of turned out in one narrow example there. You see that happening more widely? What, that we're kind of have one foot in each world now? That the line between is going away? Is that where the antique quality comes from?
Yeah, I think the line between has pretty much gone away. I mean, I'm particularly for people, you know, people under 20. I don't think they have the line in the same way. Even for some people in their 20s, I don't think they. They have the line in the same way. And I think that when I can remember, I'm old enough to dimly remember. It's one of my earliest memories. Mm-hmm. I remember my father bringing home the first television set we ever had, which was probably the first one I ever saw. And it was made of wood. It was a wooden television set with a small round screen. So if I can remember that, it means that I can also remember the world before television, but I can't really remember the world before television in the sense of what it was like. And I don't think any of us can now. I don't think we know what it's like. I think that television changed us. It changed things. It changed us. And we became a part of the world of broadcast television,
and lived partly in that world. In the
yes,
so I mean, we by now that's second nature, like breathing out and breathing in.
We don't know what it would be like to not have broadcast television. You know, once you cross one of these lines, You're in the other country. And I think with what I started out in 1981 calling cyberspace, I think we're in the other country, and people won't even bother to reference it anymore. It has become where we are, really.
And broadcast TV now increasingly itself being seen as kind of a relic.
Yes. I almost said radio.
As a radio, well. But if we have some sense of what it meant to live, you know, half with the Partridge family and half at home, what does it mean to live half in cyberspace and half on the street?
Well, I think it may be more than... I suspect it's on its way to being more than half because most of the time we're connected in some way, and we will be increasingly. I mean, the iPhone is probably the beginning of the next jump further into whatever it is that we're doing here.
Does it expand our humanity to have it living on more than one old realm? Or does it diminish it? Does it leave us just confused or enlightened? How do you see it?
Well, it's always seemed to me that a really central part of my job is to remain as agnostic as possible about that. I can't interrogate this material as a Luddite, and I can't interrogate it as a technophile. And, you know, we all have our inner Luddite and our inner technophile.
Yes, indeed.
But I have to put them aside and come from a position that the technology is neutral until human beings do things with it. The moral value of technology, I think, has to do with what we do with it and not with what it is or what its potential might be.
Mm. Let's take a call. William Gibson from Reykjavik, Iceland. Jared is on the line. Hi, Jared. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Great to have you.
I'm a big fan of the show, and I've also been a reader of William Gibson for a long, long time, so it's kind of an honor. My question for Mr. Gibson was, throughout the arc of your writing, you've kind of gone from talking about things far, far in the future to your recent books more and more and more grounded in the present day. And I'm sort of wondering what's behind that transition.
William Gibson.
Well, when I started writing science fiction as a kind of a self-aware practitioner, I had just gotten a degree in English literature, and while doing that, I'd managed to look at a lot of science fiction because I was already familiar with it, and it was easy for me to write about. And one of the conclusions I'd come to is that science fiction is never about the future, really. That's just our storytelling convention in our culture for it. When you go back and read the science fiction of the 1930s or the 1940s or the 19th century, it's always about the day in which it was written. It's inescapable. You make up an imaginary future, and as you're typing it, it's becoming quaint.
So the themes, the issues are of the present, even if the setting is dressed in an imagined future.
Yes, and 1984 is called 1984 because it's about 1948, sure. The year in which it was written. It's not called 1987. Orwell didn't need to invent very much. He just had to look at the decade he had just lived through, and see the potential of totalitarianism. So I started from there. The world of Neuromancer is a globalized world of second stage capitalism. It doesn't call itself that. The United States of Neuromancer, if indeed the United States exists in Neuromancer, mm-hmm. and I was very careful to make it impossible to prove that mm-hmm. in the text, is a world. I saw it. It's sort of Reaganomics carried to the ultimate extreme. So there's no middle class, and it's like Mexico. It's like Mexico City. That was the template I used to arrive at that effect. I didn't just hit the film noir button,
right,
and Blade Runner it up. I had to have something. I had to have some sort of armature, sort of socioeconomic armature there. So I knew that. I knew that my second three-book set, which I refuse to call a trilogy, is set in more or less in, it was written in the late 90s, but I think it's actually set in 2007. Or thereabout, in a world that can't possibly exist. And more importantly to me, it was inhabited by characters who are very much of the time in which the book is written.
So you're talking about Virtual Light, Idoru,
yeah,
All Tomorrow's Parties.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I very consciously made no effort to write those characters as though they inhabited a fully rounded imaginary future.
So they weren't far in the future at all. They were just over the horizon. But this time you put February 06 right in the first page. I mean, you've nailed it in the future, even in the present, even the past.
Yes, I actually added that. I added that date because I noticed that there were at least three reviews of Pattern Recognition that I saw that assumed it was taking place in the far future.
Even though it came out in 2003 and was determinedly set there in your mind.
Yes. So I wanted to make it obvious up front that it was a novel of the recent past. I tried to talk my publisher into subtitling it a speculative novel of the very recent past, but they wouldn't go for it.
The marketing department wasn't flying along with that.
No.
But still, to Jared's question, out of Reykjavik, I mean, you were dipping into the future, or, I mean, you came out of those earlier books with a reputation as a kind of seer on seeing cyberspace, imagining it before most of us, globalization, no middle class, that's a huge theme now. And you must have made a decision. I think you've said you made it after 9/11 to nail it in the here and now rather than leave that future frame hanging around your work. Why?
Well, I had been saying for about 15 years in the course of interviews and trying to explain my idea of what I'm doing, as opposed to the cultural model of of our cultural model of science
Jules
fiction.
Jules Verne,
I'd been saying that, given the state of the present, that I believed it would be possible for me to write a fully contemporary novel that would have the exact affect of these fictions set in imaginary futures that I'd been writing before. And I like to imagine that if there was some sort of digital audio archive set up to analyze everything I've said in interviews throughout the entire course of my career, that a good 20 or 30% of it would be devoted to my having denied prescience. I don't think I'm prescient. I don't think trend spotters are prescient, and I think that's much closer. That's much closer to what I do. I think I have a certain talent for recognizing new things that are going to become more obvious with time.
Well, let me ask you about then. You'd rather be known then maybe as just a keen observer or a deep observer. One phrase that comes up in the new book, in the mouths of one of your characters, is a cold civil war, a cold civil war underway in the United States. Do you see that? Are we in the midst of it and just haven't recognized it yet, along with William Gibson?
Well, one of my, the character who uses that phrase has an extremely eccentric viewpoint culturally. Like one of the things I do on a very regular basis, and it's a very sort of modern literary move, is to present the realities of really extreme characters who are not only eccentric narrators, but unreliable narrators. It's like the unreliable narrator is a standard chord change in modern,
so watch out.
Yeah, in modern literature. So it's not that it isn't about whether or not I think that's going on, but it is about, I suppose, my wanting the reader to sort of glance sideways and briefly entertain that.
Consider it.
Yeah, to consider it and how it would look. And then to consider how it would look to a Cuban Chinese professional criminal who'd been trained before Castro by the KGB. Like that's a pretty eccentric point of view. And that's who sees it as a cold civil war. But I think it's an interesting way to look at it.
And right there, we're in one of the streams of A Spook Country, William Gibson's latest. Let's take a call from Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air with William Gibson.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was going to ask Mr. Gibson if he realized that there were two Boston-based bands named after, I believe, I haven't read any of his books, but one of the band's name is Count Zero, and the other one is Blue Nine, and I think they're references to his book.
Count Zero, certainly. You've got rock and roll bands named after you in Boston and maybe elsewhere, William Gibson. Are you aware, Mark wants to know?
Oh, well, I may or may not be aware of those specific bands, but somewhere at home I have a file drawer filled with cassettes that I've been given over the years by many, many, many bands that have briefly been named after things in my novels. But you know, I'm glad it's still happening. I haven't heard of any bands named after things in my more recent novels, which would be really cool.
Give it time. I wonder if you'd read a little bit for us, William Gibson. You began to introduce to us one of your characters, Tito, the Cuban Chinese criminal living in, I guess, New York. There's a bit here in a chapter called Ants in the Water, where he's interacting with the old man who, correct me if I'm wrong, but seems to be maybe some retired, semi-retired, not retired intelligence mogul power from who's still at work. He collects iPods, and Lord knows what's in them. Could you set that up and read for us?
Yeah, certainly. This is the beginning of the book's second chapter, and it was originally the beginning of the book, and for complicated reasons, I switched the order, but I sort of had these visuals for months, and I didn't have Tito or the old man, which was kind of the very spooky for me beginning of the book.
And here we go.
Because I had no idea where it was going, but this is what that became. The old man reminded Tito of those ghost signs fading high on the windowless sides of blackened buildings, spelling out the names of products made meaningless by time. If Tito were to see one of these announcing the very latest, the most recent and terrible news, yet could know that it had always been there, fading, through every kind of weather, unnoticed until today, that might feel something like meeting the old man in Washington Square beside the concrete chess tables and carefully passing him an iPod beneath a folded newspaper. Each time the old man, expressionless and looking elsewhere, pocketed another iPod, Tito noticed the dull gold of his wristwatch, its dial and hands almost lost behind the worn plastic crystal. A dead man's watch, like the ones jumbled in battered cigar boxes at the flea market. His clothes were like a dead man's as well, cut from fabrics Tito imagined exuding their own chill, a cold distinct from the end of this uneven New York winter. The cold of unclaimed baggage, of institutional corridors, of steel lockers scoured to bare metal. But surely this was costume, the protocol of appearance. The old man could not be genuinely poor and do business with Tito's uncles. Sensing an immense patience and power, Tito imagined that this old man, for reasons of his own, disguised himself as a revenant from Lower Manhattan's past. Each time the old man received another iPod, accepting it the way an ancient and sagacious ape might accept a piece of some not particularly interesting fruit, Tito half expected him to crack its virginal white case like a nut and then to draw forth something utterly peculiar, utterly dire, and somehow terrible in its contemporaneity.
William Gibson reading from Spook Country, his latest novel, and things somehow terrible in their contemporaneity, emerging from iPods. And suddenly, all the technology around us is sort of quivering with dark potential. Rob's calling from Boston. Hi, Rob. You're on the air with William Gibson.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to address something Mr. Gibson said earlier about neutral technology. He said that, and I'm not sure he was talking about his writing and taking that view, that perspective as an author, or whether he was making a comment ultimately on his outlook on technology in general. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question I had was, and by the way, I read Neuromancer when I was, an undergraduate in a science fiction English class with a bunch of other novels of the time, Ursula K. Le Guin and whatnot, and I was really entranced by that book, and then there was also this piece early in the 90s that you wrote for Google, a Wired magazine,
mm-hmm.
And I think it was called Disneyland with a Death Penalty about Singapore.
Yes.
At the time I thought that was really prescient, and you couldn't help but make some comparisons between that, your travel log and your description of things there, and how you're sort of feeling at ease when you ultimately got on the airplane and left.
He leaves us with the question about your characterization of you as having treated technology as neutral. I guess it leaves me wondering about, you may think you've described it as neutral, but your books are almost all described as painting dystopias.
Well, I don't think that I've never actually agreed with. I've never agreed with that characterization of my work as dystopian. Mm. I mean, whether it is or not actually depends on where you're living, and there are lots of places in the world where people would jump at the chance to immigrate to the world of Neuromancer. There are countries that would
be empty. Get me out of here.
Emptied.
I'll go there. Right.
Yeah, there would be countries that would be emptied in an hour if everybody could magically move into Neuromancer. When I wrote Neuromancer, I wrote it in 1981, and I regarded it as a gesture of unqualified optimism to imagine that there was going to be a future at all, because that was still in the age of mutually assured destruction.
Nuclear fear.
Yeah. I mean, we've moved right out of that. We don't even, somehow we don't even remember that.
So that was your vision of a rosy future, to have a future at all?
Yeah, it was what science fiction was doing in those days. Like in genre science fiction was doing really a lot of sort of Mad Max post-nuclear apocalyptic
right.
stuff. Mm-hmm. And people were, the zeitgeist was like afloat in not unreasonable assumptions that the Soviet Union and the United States would wake up one day and do each other, and that would be all she wrote for the species.
So life was a gift, even if dark, but it got painted as dystopia. I wonder about, I mean, here now, the Washington Post reads Spook Country, your latest, and here's how they describe it. They say it's an overtly political book that takes an unsparing look at a country, the USA, awash in confusion, fear, and pervasive paranoia, a country torn apart by an endless unpopular war in Iraq. There's the Washington Post describing your latest. Is that how you see it?
Well, I hope it's not. I hope they're not saying that it's a didactic novel, because it's E.M. Forster's theory of didacticism in the novel was sort of my key guide when I started out. And
you don't want to beat us over the head with lessons and the teachings of William Gibson.
Well, Forster got it down to the idea that if an author is in control of the characters, that author is not doing his or her job at all. Mm-hmm. And I can't, if I write a book, the guy who's sitting here talking with you, like if I make up a book in my head and write that out and let it express my my editorial opinion.
The way it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the way it is. It's not going to be, it's just not going to be a good book. It's not going to be a good book in Forster's opinion, which matters to me. That said, if given that I see my job now as trying to invite the zeitgeist in for tea and find out what it's about, it seems like the zeitgeist is very political these days.
Yes, and it shows up. There's a bit here where you've got one of your characters and he suddenly finds himself saying, a nation consists of its laws. A nation does not consist of its situation at a given time. If an individual's morals are situational, that individual is without morals. If a nation's laws are situational, that nation has no laws and soon isn't a nation. Well, you're right in the middle of the political zeitgeist there. I mean,
well,
boom.
Exactly. But the thing that I most like about that is that character is speaking from a blackout. He has to be so disinhibited.
Right.
So disinhibited.
Only when the power's down.
when the power's down, these voices, various voices speak through Milgram, this particular character,
right.
who spends all his time reading a history of really, really kinky medieval heresies.
Right, and his unfortunate addiction to Ativan and I don't know what else has made him the puppet of a sort of a dark intelligence agent himself. William Gibson, we have a lot of listeners who want to speak with you. I don't want to leave them hanging too long. From Tampa, Florida, Ross is on the line. Hi, Ross. You're on the air with William Gibson.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. What do you know?
I just want to thank Mr. Gibson for writing some great novels. I was a big fan of these new ones, and I wanted to ask him why he set so much of his novels about Case in the Far East, in Hong Kong, on the streets of Chiva, if he'd been over there, if it's just something he thought up.
William Gibson.
Oh, well, thanks. I'm glad you liked him. You know, I hadn't been to, When I wrote Neuromancer, I hadn't been to Japan. And then Neuromancer became a hit in translation in Japan because I had a brilliant and kind of crazy translator. It did some took some really weird liberties, apparently. Great. And so then I got to go to Japan. But the reason I said it in Japan was when I wrote it in 1981, there still hadn't been that Time cover story about Japan, threat or menace, they're taking over the world.
Right.
Whoa, look at everything in your house is made by the Japanese. So, but I was on to that. That was what, you know, I knew that everything I owned that was of any value, including my car, had been made in Japan. And the Japanese presence in Vancouver, where I lived in and still live, was very big. And my wife, for several years before then, had been teaching English as a second language, mostly to Japanese students. Mm-hmm. So I got to meet these Japanese kids who'd come in every like 3 months or so, speaking very little English. And by the time they left, I could have conversations with them. And I kind of imagined the place they came from, and then I tried to imagine what the place they came from might be like in like 2030 or whenever that is. I was always careful to say not to say exactly when it was. But then once I actually went there, I was just like totally hooked on it because I loved it. And like I've never been bored for 2 seconds.
So you weren't Bill Murray sitting lost in translation in Tokyo. You were into it.
Yeah, no, I was like wandering the streets like mesmerized by the shape of fire hydrants.
Right, yeah.
Every last bit is different.
I should know that feeling. Let's get another call from Hatsy in Hamilton, Massachusetts. Hatsy, you're on the air with William Gibson.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
About 9 years ago, I think, I was commissioned by a national magazine to write a story about book groups in this
mm-hmm.
country
mm-hmm.
and what was happening. And I contacted a group of young women, mostly in their early 30s, young marrieds, young mothers, and all Yale educated, which is mm-hmm. sort of curious. Hmm. And I asked them who they were reading and what really grabbed them.
And what part of the country, what kind of work were they in?
In L.A.
Okay,
they were all living in L.A., and either they had been in the entertainment field or their husbands were.
Okay.
An ambitious, thoughtful young group of women
right.
who were actually raising young children.
Right.
And their book group, an all-women's book group, read almost exclusively William Gibson's books.
And
wow.
You were their hero. And when they finished one, they would often reread it just to discuss it again. So, then I began reading your books too. But what obsessed these women, these privileged, educated young women? What in your stories grabbed them? Do you think it wasn't just the great storytelling? It had to be something deeper. And how do you feel about being sort of a cult figure for this group?
That's remarkable news to me.
Young moms, well-educated in the entertainment business, loving William Gibson.
Well, on my end of it, and this did begin to change a bit with pattern recognition, when I do book signings, the audience has always been predominantly male, and when I see a woman coming in the line, I go, okay, a
all
woman's
right.
read my book. And and all too often they say, well, my boyfriend couldn't come, but his name is Charlie, and
right,
if you could
right.
make this out to him.
Yeah.
So and I've always, you know, golly, that's like great news.
Hatsy, what did you make of it, Hatsy? What's your interpretation? You've read him now, and you know them.
I did. I really wondered if it was the strangeness, the violence. I didn't really know. I I still wonder what it is. I should go back to those women today. They're 10 years older or 9 years older.
Well,
and,
one thing that it might be, and I may I'm probably flattering myself on this, but when I began to write science fiction, the only, like, I was looking at, like, what was going on in science fiction, and it was like the Country Channel. And it was just like, it seemed like just like Nashville product to me. And the only place that anything was really, really happening where there was like kind of radical energy was in feminist science fiction in the early 80s. There was Ursula Le Guin and Joanna Russ and that crowd of people. And they were writing... there was the most excitement. They were having the most fun. So I took that on. And not that I actually read that many feminist SF novels, but it was important to me from the start to try to have strong and, as much as possible, believable female characters. And it continues to be. And there's also, I just couldn't write a book that was just guys.
Yeah.
Because it's like, they're not such good company after a while.
Hatsy, thank you very much for the field report, and we're glad you're still reading. Let me get one more from Lexington, Massachusetts. Duncan. Duncan, you're on the air.
Hi. How's it going? Hello, Mr. Gibson.
Hi.
Very good. Thank you.
Noticed when you did your reading from Spook Country that the old subject of a watch came up, and I've noticed since the bridge, No, It's Not a Trilogy, and Forward, and your article in Wired, that watches seem to be this fascination of yours, and I'm wondering whether they've replaced long chain monomers in your writing.
Well. I think the long-chain monomers were more of a tick, although there are long-chain monomers in Spook Country.
Now, what's a long-chain monomer? Bring us up to speed.
I was told once that long-chain monomers are what you're actually smelling when you're getting that new car smell.
Oh, all right. So a molecular
really,
structure.
Yeah, and they're kind of highly unnatural molecular structures, and they're really, really
yummy.
not too good for you.
Right.
The watch thing was the result of my doing this experiment where I tried to cultivate, actually quite successfully, an obsession, as I'd never actually had a hobby. I got to a point in my life where it was time to have a hobby,
yeah.
And I thought I would try to have a hobby anyway. So I went through like seven or eight years of learning. And then subsequently forgetting most of a huge body of knowledge, pointless, exquisitely pointless knowledge about vintage 20th century wristwatches. Not the carriage trade sort, and large, but funky and obscure things. And I happily let it spill over into my fiction.
So when a dead man's watch looks like the ones jumbled in battered cigar boxes at the flea market, you know that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. And the flea market would have been the what they called the garage at the Chelsea flea market in Manhattan, but that's gone now, and I'm yet to visit. I'm yet to visit its replacement in Hell's Kitchen, and when I do, I'll pretty much be a civilian. Like I haven't bought a vintage watch in a couple of years now, so I think it's like I'm clean.
you're clean. Now on to iPods. There's a sentence sort of midway in the book. It says he closed his own eyes and flew through the night somewhere above the country he hoped was still America. You may not call it dystopia, but you keep that fear, that concern, brightly alive in Spook Country.
Well, you know, people have quoted that, but what they take it out of, and I'm not denying my attempt to
salt it in,
to push people's cognitive dissonance button. That's part of my function. But that really that is meant to be ambivalent, because the character is worried that he's already been flown to Mexico City. He literally doesn't know where he is, and he doesn't want to go to Mexico City.
Working the line again, William Gibson, it's been great talking with you. Our watch is running us right off the air here, but it's wonderful to have you. The new book is Spook Country. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's been great.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.